This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
The first African-American Normal Town Council member says the 2016 election did not make a difference in her decision to run.
I've always been active. It was always pushed, once again, from my grandmother to constantly stay active, that I have a duty to be involved.
A conversation with Kimberly Cummings, plus part two of the GLT interview with State Representative Dan Brady. He responds to a suggestion that people boycott lawmakers' private businesses until a budget deal gets done. There's a celebration of creativity, inclusion, and collaboration. Hear more. And the wisdom of healing gardens.
All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Two women made history during the community's most recent municipal elections. Voters elected the first African Americans to the Normal Township Board and the Town of Normal Council. Kimberly Cummings is the first black woman to serve on the town council. During the election, she spoke of diversity and representing that diversity on the council. In our series of interviews with newly elected municipal officials, Cummings tells GLT's Mike McCurdy that while this is her first elected office, she comes from a family where her grandmother was involved in politics.
I grew up with her dragging me and my sister. There was two places she dragged us to. One was to church and the other one was on campaigns. When we would go door to door knocking, and we rode in parades and passed out literature to help candidates and locally in Cleveland, Ohio. And just overall her support. I started off in college as an education major. I was upset with some of the legislation at the time, which was the No Child Left Behind Act. And it really, I took that to heart, because the students who I so desperately wanted to serve and make a difference in their life, I felt like this new legislation was doing them a disservice, and it was an injustice. And so I changed my major to political science. The trail for that decision, initially I thought about one day becoming the Secretary of Education. The next thought was, oh my gosh, that will never happen. So you better think realistically. And so I started looking into whether I would do nonprofit or do work within a municipality. And I decided, you know, nonprofit, it's hard to get started because you don't get paid. And I said, well, maybe I'll take a journey and become a city manager. Life happens, and, you know, never thought of it. But, you know, my grandmother still encouraged me to get involved and do different things along the way.
Is the political science degree you have, is being a normal town council person the first practical application of that?
Yes. It would be the first.
Or at least specific application. I'm sure it's come in handy.
It certainly has come in handy many times. You know, the way we think, you think critically, you learn to think independently. I think I wrote more papers in my undergrad days than I could ever imagine writing, because one thing that I had great professors who, it wasn't that they taught you specifically straight from a book. They'll teach you something, but then they wanted you to talk about it and share your thoughts or how you would have handled things differently.
How did the 2016 presidential election factor into your decision to run, or did it?
To be honest, it did not. I've always been active. It was always pushed, once again, from my grandmother to constantly stay active, that I have a duty to be involved. So for me, the 2016 election was, I get up, I wash my face, and I say, you know what do I have to do in today to make a difference? And that's literally how I get up every day. My number one goal is how can I make a difference? Whether it's me running for office or leading a women's ministry or just speaking to young people, I am here on a mission. And that is what gets me going. 2016 election, it was a disappointment to see that we could elect someone to an office that was once held to such high esteem, who to me is incapable of holding that office. But it was not a wake-up call. It was now who's going to get involved and so that I'm not out here by myself.
In the League of Women Voters Guide, you stated the town of Normal is diverse and the city council should be as diverse in order to present a true feeling of one community with many voices. And in the Pantograph, you're quoted as saying, many residents feel diversity and inclusion is just tongue-in-cheek. And you ask, how do you make all citizens feel welcome? How do you make everyone feel welcome and represent the many voices in this community as a council person?
One thing you have to make sure that you share with them that you hear them. People, just in general, no matter who we are, we all want to be heard. We all want to be recognized, and we always want to feel a part. And I think when things are not seeming segmented, information, whether it's information being dispersed or how we cater certain things, that it seems like it's catered to everyone instead of just a group of people or a section of people or certain demographic. So those are things we can start to look at. And when we make those decisions, and usually as long as I've been alive, because I've been an African-American and I've been a woman all my life, usually people do it sometimes, even the most people who think they're the most innocent, because it's just innate in us sometimes to do things that seem normal, but it's not, you know, or we say something and don't realize the impact. You know, I've had to deal with that where if I don't straighten my hair, you know, nobody else say anything about my hair. But if I straighten it, it's like, oh, your hair is really pretty. And, you know, to some person, one person, it was all innocent and they thought it was just a common thing you do. You compliment someone on their hair. But it's kind of also condescending because you wait till I was not in my natural state of hair to compliment me. So it's things like that we have to always be cognizant. We have to take that same mindset when we're making ordinances or coming up with ideas that we don't cross that fine line.
I'm sure I've stepped on those landmines myself. How do you react when someone does that innocently? You know, maybe compliments you when you've straightened your hair, but when you have a fro, they don't say anything about it.
It's one of those things I've had to grow into. There's been a time in my life where I took it personal and I've had hard feelings about it, or I've had gotten angry. I guess I'm to a point now where if I'm comfortable with you, I'll let you know, like, kind of bordering some lines there. If I don't, you know, I let it ride because that's their ignorance. But my hope is that they come across the right person who feels comfortable enough to tell them that that's maybe not a way to approach a situation.
You're listening to Sound Ideas and a series of interviews with newly elected town and city council members. Soon you'll hear from Ward 9 Alderman Kim Bray. And at WGLT.org, you can hear the Sound Ideas interview with Ward 1 Alderman and Jamie Mathey. I'm Mike McCurdy, in with the newest town council member, Town of Normal council member, Kimberly Cummings. Even though the council won't vote on the next budget until March, city staff is already working on it and considering service cuts to deal with flat to declining sales tax receipts and the loss of tax dollars as a result of the dissolution of the Metro Zone. Here's what City Manager Mark Peterson had to say during an interview last week during Sound Ideas.
It takes about 4 months to get that process completed, and we present our preliminary budget to the council in January of each year.
So could you put a word on the next Town of Normal budget? Austere, lean?
Yes. Yes, both.
Both of those.
Austere and lean, and in fact, we'll be talking to the council probably this summer, maybe July or August, about some measures that we're going to be recommending to get this on their radar screen so they're prepared when that budget hits their desks in January.
City Manager Mark Peterson on Sound Ideas. It sounds as though you may be faced with some tough decisions come January. What are your priorities as staff prepares a budget that might pare down some services, things you think are important to preserve?
Two things I think of when I think of how do we preserve anything. Number one, how does it best serve our residents? And then number two, what challenges does it present to the quality of life? And so those are the two things that I'll keep in the forefront of my mind as we make those decisions. Because at the end of the day, it's the people we serve. It's the people who elected us to be here and make the best decisions possible. And that's who we have to take a look at and put in the forefront of our mind as we make those decisions.
I assume core city services would be important.
Absolutely. You know,
garbage,
things,
water,
those
police,
things,
fire.
Yeah, because that falls right into that line of quality of service. You know, to remove those things would diminish significantly the quality of life here in town. So, yes, those fall right in line with my second point.
How do you think staff and maybe individual council members ought to move forward after the acrimony created by the unilateral abandonment of the Metrozone agreement by Bloomington? Is there moving forward?
There is always a moving forward point. It's like anything. It's you have to think about how do you want to repair a relationship? Because that's basically, at the end of the day, yes, we know there's a contractual part to it. But at the core or center of it all is a relationship that's involved. It's almost like a marriage. You've got the marriage and then you've got children that are involved in it. And, you know, how do you move forward for the sake of the children? How do you move forward in order to do what's right for our constituents? And how do we have to make it work? We're only better together, both Bloomington and Normal, than to be separated and to make decisions separately.
Ward 1 Alderman Jamie Matthews said he's meeting in small groups with elected officials from Normal and says interpersonal communication is a way to move on from things like the Metrozone. Are you meeting with any of your counterparts in Bloomington?
I have not met with any of them yet. I've only received one email so far, or reach out, I should say, that, you know, asking, can we meet? So, you know, I'm opening to listening. You know, I'm new, so I guess I've got a lot to learn, and I want to hear what people think. I want to know what's on their brains, because I'm one of those people who I don't just close my ears to what you have to say. You know, whether we agree or disagree, I'm here to at least listen.
And will you be reaching out to Bloomington Council members?
I can certainly do that.
On the table in talks between aldermen and council members is the notion of a municipal shared sales tax agreement. What are your thoughts on a shared sales tax agreement between Bloomington and Normal?
It's, you know, there's not a lot out there right now about what might go into that. And for me, before I could, and that's just the logical part of me, before I could even make that decision or say, yes, this would be great, or no, this would not, I would really want to know the details and the ins and outs and what that would look like. I think, especially coming from a situation where there was some mutual understanding before and some mutual agreement, we definitely want to take a look at what's going to be a part of that shared sales tax.
And then some of the problems Normal is having with its budget is the fact that sales taxes are down. What are some options or strategies to actually grow the sales tax in this community?
That's a very difficult one, because that's not a question that's just this community is facing. This is a national issue. One of the biggest things that I think that we're not talking about or putting any pressure on, and I don't know, maybe it might come back around. I know at one point there was some talk in the legislature about putting some requirements about the sales tax from online. I think I would like to see some stuff move with that, because that would not only just help Bloomington Normal, but, you know, we're talking about a national, in a sense, crisis here, where a lot of cities are failing because of the loss of sales tax. And it's hard. It's really disheartening at this point.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy, talking with Town of Normal Councilmember Kimberly Cummings, sworn into office in May. During the GLT League of Women Voters candidate forum, you favored some sort of cooperation between the communities on library services. Where are you on that, as both communities seem poised to develop separate facilities at this point?
You know, it would be nice if there were things that we could do collectively. I think there are opportunities, you know, across the board to combine some things, maybe make it easier. I do know that there are some obstacles just because there's some different setups between the two cities and between the city and the town. But they're not insurmountable, you know, but I think we've got a long way to go, I think, to a degree, to before we get there. And not in a bad way. It's just being able to get a good focus. I think we have some things that come up before that. One, talking about the budget and how do you increase, you know, revenue where we're losing in sales tax. I think those things are so much at the forefront to talk, start having conversations about combining some of those entities, like a library, is really not at the top of the list at this moment. Doesn't mean we can't come back to it.
Are there other areas of cooperation that are higher up on the list that you think are possible?
I'm sure there's many. I know that there's been conversations about the fire station, you know, to reduce fire time, and there's, and that's just to name one. So I think we're in a place to talk about some of them, but there's just some that come before others.
Sure.
Right now.
The library is just one competing priority. Another is a multi-sports complex on the town's west side. Should public money, town money, be part of the equation? And what's the balance if there's a public-private partnership?
That's always difficult. And because you have so many people who are against any type of input from the public.
Financial input.
For financial input. It's got to be a balance. It has to make sense. And I don't have the numbers or the figures to say, hey, this is 100% good. This is what, you know, what we should contribute. But one thing I do know, that there's a lot of economic development, not just locally here, but many cities. I've read up on numerous cities who have now adopted this new way of doing economic development. They're thriving. They're growing cities.
Sports marketing.
Yes, yeah. Also into sports marketing. So, and so there's many. There's, matter of fact, our neighboring state, Indiana, has a complex out there where they've been able to grow and gain some revenue. So it's not unheard of, but I think right now everything is kind of, and especially for me, maybe there might be some that have been in this a little bit longer who have a little bit more information. But until I guess, get a little bit more information to where I feel comfortable to say this is a sure thing that we need to invest in or take a look at.
If it is an investment, what kind of return would you like to see? In other words, what do you think the benefits to the community are financially and otherwise to some sort of complex like that?
To a complex like that, you're not just looking at what the complex itself brings. I mean, you're looking at hotel, motel tax. You're looking at sales tax. You're looking at food and beverage tax, because people will eventually use it for tournaments, which will draw not just locally. I mean, you could even get to a point where you're drawing nationally. And so the amount of people that would flock here, you know, and it brings a new presence to our town. So that's something to be proud of. But when you start adding up those additional revenues, you know, people shopping in our stores, a lot of times I know, like with my husband and I, we don't eat chains or shop in chain places when we go out of town. We eat locally. We shop locally. The normal things that you just can't find anywhere else, that's where we go to. And so those are the things that'll draw to our town.
We touched on the library. It would be an uptown anchor, specifically part of Uptown 2.0, south of the tracks. People have to get there and get back and forth between the tracks or over or under the tracks. Where is your support falling with the recommendation offered by the consultants who studied the underpass options, and what about funding it?
So I will save my choice for our vote when we decide to vote. And I've mentioned it before, so kind of where I stand. And but I will say this.
You've mentioned it before. Where are you leaning?
Last I checked that I was leaning, not to say that it won't change, because anything is possible. And that's the one thing I want people to understand. You get new information, you are afforded more numbers, more dollars, mm-hmm. different things can happen. And so what I may say now could change just with a new packet of information coming to me tomorrow.
Sure.
And one thing that I stated even when I was on campaign trail, that I lean more towards the underpass. And it, when you're talking about, when you see, it's almost like buying a car. You can get the initial sticker shock from the initial costs. But then when you start talking about how much the gas costs, how much maintenance goes into it versus you pay for a cheaper car, but all the maintenance that might come with that and how often you have to put gas in the tank, either they either balance or sometimes what seems cheaper really isn't cheaper in the end.
And what about funding? Should the town put any money toward that? Should they hold off until they're able to find state and federal grants?
I think it would be nice if we could find other opportunities or other ways to fund. That would be top priority. I think any town or city would do that first before just jumping in and say, well, we're going to foot the bill immediately for it. There's many ways to fund a project or take a look at how we can fund it or how we make it happen. So I think we'll have to be very strategic on how we do that because it will be a chunk of money that we're forcing out for that. So,
all right. Kimberly Cummings, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas and congratulations on the election.
Thank you very much.
Normal Town Council member Kimberly Cummings. She spoke with GLT's Mike McCurdy. She was elected in April and sworn into office in May. At WGLT.org, find an interview with Bloomington Ward 1 Alderman Jamie Mathey, and our series of interviews with newly elected council members concludes with Ward 9 Alderman Kimberly Bray. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Economic Development Council, presenting BN by the Numbers Thursday, June 29th at ISU's Bone Student Center, a local economic update with a special focus on small business development. Registration available by emailing Becky at bnbiz.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, looking at art through other eyes. Yesterday, State Representative Dan Brady said during GLT Sound Ideas he's optimistic a budget might finally come this summer. The Bloomington Normal Republican said rank-and-file members of the General Assembly were feeling more pressure from constituents than ever before because of the damage done to the state by the two-and-a-half-year standoff. Today, Brady continues the conversation addressing the question that does this new activism by backbenchers when the budget is resolved permanently weaken the Speaker of the House and the governor because the rank and file have had to act more on their own than they have had to do in a considerable period of time?
I would like to think that we can come out of this stronger. Obviously, it's very painful. It continues to be devastating for many. But if we can come out of this stronger from a standpoint of caucuses knowing that, you know what, we need to look at our leaders closer. No one person should have the power they can hold hostage, if you will, the state of Illinois, governor, speaker, or anyone else as far as that goes. I think we come out stronger if we look at those type of things. Now, that remains to be seen. But if we don't come out of this learning a lot of different things and implementing things, I, for one, believe the face of higher education in the state of Illinois will forever be changed because of our financial situation right now and our impasse. That's just higher education. I believe also things will be changed forever when it comes to social service agencies and what the state of Illinois is able to financially do for those agencies. And the list goes on. You can even talk about K through 12. So I hope we come out stronger from the standpoint politically. That was your initial
question.
That's
the question, yeah.
And I hope that's the case, that we come out learning that no one person should have the ability to have so much power concentrated in one area that they can cause this type of problem.
Well, more than a million people have had services cut. Isn't that a rather high price to pay for this wisdom?
Absolutely. It's a high price to pay. But the reality is, what do we do about this? What do we learn from it? Does a caucus learn that there should be term limits for leaders? Does a caucus learn, or the electorate learn, that consequences, elections do have consequences? And when you elect individuals and their caucus elects them into power, that there should be more checks and balances. There should be something that is more of a safeguard. And then I think if more than anything else, I hope that individual caucuses and individual representatives learn that collectively, together, we can force change.
I have had people approach me in the community and say, it would be appropriate, since lawmakers have not done their jobs, that we not patronize their businesses in the community. Mm-hmm. These are not fringy people. These are Republicans, some Democrats. They're lawyers. They're State Farm workers. They're neither doctrinaire liberals nor right-end conservatives. What do you tell them about that suggestion?
Well, what I would tell them is that that's certainly their choice. I think that they might want to back up and think about their representative or senator and what kind of service they provide. There's policy. And you can say to somebody that I don't like the policy coming out of Springfield. I don't like the way things are being done. But as far as a representative goes or a senator goes, is that individual there, accessible, providing services for me, helping me through anything I need to try and navigate through Springfield? Are they representing me? And if it was solely up to me, Dan Brady, and I could get 117 of my colleagues to do exactly what I want, it'd be different. But we have something called democracy. And sometimes democracy gets very, very ugly, very, very muddied up. But I believe that we can come out of this stronger than what we have been. And obviously, we need to learn some of the things I'm talking about and implement some of the changes, because the financials for the state, this is not going to be when we get a budget. The problem doesn't go away. It's a systemic problem, and that's what Governor Reiner has been trying to get to, I believe, right or wrong. And so people with their ideas and whatever they want to do or not do, that's their individual right. But I think to say that someone, because they provide goods and services in a private business, and they do that very well, somehow we shouldn't patronize them because of what's going on in Springfield. I don't think that's a reflection on their business. And I think, quite frankly, that's unfair, short-sighted. And I think that individuals, if we had a budget tomorrow and it was flashed all over the radio, on the airwaves, and in print media, and on television, I bet you people I would see in the streets would say, that's great, thank you very much. It wouldn't have a clue. Most people wouldn't have a clue what it really meant that you had a budget or not, was it balanced, was it just the fact that the pressure would be off and they'd feel better about it.
It would seem that if state government is contracting and decisions are devolving on local communities to do the public tasks that they decide are important, that the local communities need the flexibility to make those decisions. The governor continues to insist on a property tax freeze. Is that still a major part of the way things should work? It is local control, after all.
Well, I think that the governor, when you talk about the property tax issue freeze, first off, you have seen the governor, I believe, move on that issue from how many years, from 12 to 10 to, yeah, to
from,
four.
From
so I think he's gone. I think he's gone back and forth, but I think he is reacting to what he believes he hears from the people of Illinois, what he has said through his campaign, what was something really a centerpiece of what he was talking about, and it was received well. People would like to have their property tax frozen. Now, I understand what that can mean down the road, K-12 education and others, but the reality of a property tax freeze, the way property taxes keep going up, is something that the governor has been steadfast about, even though he has moved back and forth on the years that that should be in place, trying to compromise. And, I think going out there and offering that, offering other things he's talked about, but being willing to compromise is very much a key. I have not heard that compromise on the other. And I think on the other side, and I think part of the things that have been proposed on the other side, whether it's workers' comp, whether it's property tax or other things, I think there's been such a mistrust between the governor and the speaker created that, again, it gets back to hopefully the ideas of what was done over in the Senate, and that be the blueprint, if you will, of what we can get done for a budget.
So the last version on that was 2 years temporary freeze, right?
The last I heard, correct.
Okay.
And I don't know. could you say take all that agenda off the table? That's exactly what the speaker wants. All that reform off the table, put through a budget, and that's the end of it. Well, we have a roughly $37 billion budget, zero flat line, if you wanted to. And that's not where the Democrats were in the last discussion I had. It was over $39 billion in revenue that they wanted. That's not supported by what we proposed. And so therein lies a big, big problem. They want more spending, but the votes weren't there for the revenue side of that. So we have to come together. You know, there will be those who could be disingenuous and vote for the spending side of things, but not the revenue side of things. That's not what we need. We need those that are going to vote for an entire package, and we need that package to reflect something that's going to be done sooner rather than later, obviously.
Yeah. You acknowledged that Unit 5 and the other schools are not
getting the money in the stopgap as fast as they should. Unit 5
says... Well, it's not just the stopgap. It was their full K-12 budget, which is set to expire June 30th.
The categoricals.
Categoricals.
Unit 5 is 8.1 million behind.
And a big part of that is transportation.
The categoricals.
Correct.
Are they ever going to see that money?
The most recent bill that I had seen that was something that really we were focused on in the House was Senate Bill 6. And it does approach higher ed more than K-12. But the concept was there to try and get back to levels of FY15 as far as spending goes to the schools. And there would be some money for 17 and 16, probably more so 17. Supplemental appropriation. But seeing that money, I can't answer, are they going to have an $8.1 million payment coming or parts of that payment over the course of the next years? I would like to believe that whatever we come up with for FY18, that there is some backfill for 17. Yes. I don't know that that's going to be a check in the mail for $8.1 million.
Something.
I would like to see it as something.
Yeah. Because they're using working cash fund money, which is essentially borrowing right now.
That's correct. And certainly those who have the reserves are able to borrow for a while. Those who don't have the reserves obviously find themselves, as some of our schools in Southern Illinois in particular, in dire straits. The reality is when what corridors do you defy, that's when you start prioritizing and putting towards what cash you do have towards schools. K-12, I think, would be a focus point that certainly the General Assembly needs to be focusing on, and they are focusing on. And so where we actually end up with, there are those, and I'll speak to our caucus, the Republican caucus, there are those absolutely are not going to vote for a stopgap budget. There are those that want the full-year budget and no ifs, ands, or buts. We'll see what happens. There are those that believe if we've got to go the stopgap again, a six-month, not my first choice, but the reality is that might take pressure off and get money out the door to help stabilize some things as this goes on.
State Representative Dan Brady of Bloomington Normal is in Republican House leadership.
Put some Texas-sized heat into your summer. SEPQ presents the GLT Summer Concert featuring Los Tex-Manians. Also on stage, Detroit's Queen of the Blues, Thornetta Davis, and Edward David Anderson's Black Dirt Revival. It's the GLT Summer Concert tomorrow on the Square in downtown Bloomington. The music starts at 5 and it's free. More info at WGLT.com.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The latest exhibition at the University Galleries is a celebration of creativity, inclusion, and collaboration. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
The walls of the University Galleries in Uptown Normal are filled with colorful works of art. That's not so unusual, except this art was created right in this space where it's being exhibited, and the artists aren't done yet.
Hi, guys. How is everybody? How are you doing? Hi, honey. Good to see you.
Mark Making, Artists of Mark First, features works created by individuals from Mark First, a local agency dedicated to supporting adults with developmental disabilities. For the past 4 months, Mark First has partnered with the University Galleries to host a series of workshops in the Airy Gallery space, allowing the artist a chance to explore new creative grounds with paintings, drawings, sculptures, and more. University Galleries curator Jason Judd says this opportunity is more than creative. It's inclusive.
All of the outreach and educational outreach workshops that we already host at University Galleries, and this fits the bill perfectly. We like to think about ourselves as a laboratory of expression and somewhere that people can see art and make art, and We like to be facilitators of everybody in the community. So it was a very easy decision to kind of collaborate with IGA in mark making.
IGA Pukalska is Mark First's arts coordinator. She says mark making allows the artist to experience art in a new way.
Because it's not like art is new to them. Most of them have grown up creating artworks. But I think this environment and being out in the community creating artwork is slightly different. So I think just the exposure and ability to experiment, ability to create is the goal. The environment is just so different than what they're used to, and they have an ownership of the program as well. So, it's something that they're proud of.
One of the artists plunging into something new today is Betty, who has created several paintings already in the workshops. Today, though, it's something new.
Hey, do you want to do some clay? Because you were absent for clay?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's really soft.
I've never done the clay yet, but I've done a lot of different paintings.
Is one of yours on the wall here?
Yeah. Let's see. Over there's my handprint.
So you did some handprints?
Yes.
Why did you do handprints?
Because I wanted to be different.
Is it good? Can you squeeze it well enough? Yeah?
Yeah.
So I can get you some forks and things too, so okay. We can start really molding it into whatever you dream of.
Curator Jason Judd says the workshops have allowed the artists to expand their skills and given them something else, something special. It's given them time for creative reflection.
Like, what are we making art of? What are we making art about? Iga and I are also collaborating on making a short documentary that will be playing in the gallery here. And when we're asking them about what they have made, they have to make these decisions and think about how to produce them, just like any artist has to, So that kind of self-reflection that every artist has to go through in decision-making, I think, is critical.
Lawson does some great artwork where he puts the paint on, folds it, smacks it down, and then opens it like Rorschach. Are you practicing already? Good. I like it. Warm up those painting muscles.
Over the past 4 months, the walls of the gallery have gradually filled up, except for one, which is reserved for a mural that Jason and Iga say will test the skills of the artists.
Who's looking on the wall?
Me.
Robbie.
Me.
Oh, man, Lawson.
Lawson.
All right. Me. Jeremy, you have your hand up?
Yeah. Okay.
If you want to...
They've really cultivated their skills over the last 4 months. They've gotten to know the space, myself, they already knew Iga, and their skills have been more refined, and, there's a big wall to tackle, and we're going to start it today, and we will continue adding on to it throughout the exhibition then.
Yeah, I think throughout the workshops, they definitely built a set of skills that... During especially the last couple of workshops, we've noticed that they took on this approach of an open studio more so than, following direction or having to follow directions, which is great because that's really the goal of them, doing whatever they are most interested in. So I think with different approaches to painting as well, I think we'll see it today on the wall. So here, let's pick out your colors.
Sure. My colors?
Yeah, which ones? Blue.
Blue.
Okay.
Red.
Red.
Green. Okay. And purple.
That's a good color palette. All right, would you like to pick your paint brushes?
Sure.
There you go. And let's get you some water. There you go. So what do you think you're going to paint?
That color.
And what else?
Yellow.
So you're going to make an abstract painting?
Yeah.
Yeah. So go for it.
The artists of mark making have taken advantage of this creative hub to find interesting sources of inspiration. Jason Judd points to a painting by an artist named Josh, who makes a lot of works about heaven and sports.
Which is an incredible combination right off the bat. And after... working with patterns a couple of times for the workshops, He made this really intriguing and kind of striking painting of these five tennis matches that are going on. But, you know, they are more circles and squares, kind of a tic-tac-toe. So they're very abstracted, but at the same time, you know, once you know that it is a game of tennis, you see that. So that kind of intricate play of representation and abstraction is something that he developed, right? And is it developed here at the workshop, or is it just in, you know, I don't think that really matters. But that's something that I think was really successful and something kind of great to look at in multiple different ways.
It doesn't matter to Josh what to call his style. He's just enthusiastic about creating and is inspired by the workshops.
I try to visualize all kinds of stuff, things so I can do all kinds of drawing, painting.
Is it important to you to do art?
Yeah, I enjoy it. I probably make much money off it, yeah.
How do you feel, Josh, about knowing that the public will be coming in here at the opening and seeing your artwork? How does that make you feel?
Great, nice, happy.
So are you going to be creating more artwork today?
Yeah, hopefully, yeah, if I can really think of more stuff, yeah.
As the artists splash the blank mural space with a riot of colors, Iga and Jason reflect on this exhibition as more than an opportunity for the artists. The community has a chance to experience something new as well.
As a society, generally, we're not very exposed to artists with disabilities. And I feel like this is a great opportunity for our community to come and visit, come and see the works produced by Mark First artists and understand what they're capable of and, you know, see the beauty and the passion and the engagement that they've been kind of cultivating throughout those last couple of months, because it is definitely something that I'm proud of. I know they are as well. But I think the exposure is really, really important for type of the social change that needs to take place in our society.
Along with what Iga is saying, I think having Mark Making and Mark First here in University Galleries is they're making art, the artists are making art here, live. You can come in, you can see the art, and you can, you know, see the workshop going on. You know, that's something that's usually in a small studio at Mark First. So it's really exposing the community to the community, right? We're all community members, and I love how kind of transparent this whole thing is. So this exhibition, you know, it's not merely just this art on the wall that we've made over the last 4 months. This is a living exhibition that the artwork is still being made in this room every 2 weeks. It's still being pinned up on the wall. It's really the hub for creativity for these artists with disabilities. And we're really proud to have them here.
That's gallery curator Jason Judd, along with Iga Pukalska from Mark First. Mark Making is currently up and continues through August 9th at the University Galleries in Uptown Normal. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can see a gallery of photos from one of the workshops plus finished works from the artists at our website, wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. People who garden often say there's more to it than caring for beautiful flowers and plants. They say gardening brings a sense of serenity and peace. Tomorrow, the University of Illinois Extension Office, along with McLean County Master Gardeners, will hold an all-day workshop on horticultural therapy at the Community Cancer Center in Normal. Horticulturalist Kelly Alsop tells GLT's Judy Valente the gardening is healing. The two begin their discussion beside the shimmering waterfall inside the Cancer Center garden.
I like to have people start here at the water fountain at the Community Cancer Center because it is such a serene sound and it really gets your mind going to start connecting to nature in the garden.
What exactly is therapeutic horticulture?
Horticulture therapy is really about how to teach people how to connect to the garden. So start connecting to plants, because what horticulture therapy is all about, it's all about the people connecting to nature. It's not about what plants you grow. And I truly believe that we were born to grow plants and be around plants and be around soil and water and listen to nature.
What types of activities then will you do with people at the workshop?
Well, I am doing a sensory gardening program. So the very first part, I'm going to, you know, take away all their senses and get them to use their imagination, particularly youth with, you know, autism or attention deficit disorder, particularly a youth that may not have the verbal skills or the social skills, but they can gain some of that in gardening as far as it improves their self-esteem, it allows them to work as a team, and it just gets them to start exploring.
The workshop just isn't for children.
You're right. It is horticulture therapy, so it's for anybody that may have had some issue preventing them from gardening as a hobby or a lifestyle. The whole conference really is, I'm just doing one little part of sensory gardening, and I'm really focusing on youth. But Mike Maddox is, you know, talking about horticulture therapy in a broader sense, meaning how do we get people with wheelchairs out into the garden? How do we get, you know, older gardeners to have it a little bit more, a little easier for them to garden?
And it sounds as though your workshop, your Saturday workshop, might be for people just who are feeling stress in their lives. Maybe they don't have a physical ailment or a specific emotional or mental disability at the moment.
Absolutely. De-stress your life and be looking at trees in the sky and hearing the wind and letting the wind blow across your face. That is de-stressing. So we're having it here at the Community Cancer Center because we actually feel like we want to tell people that gardening has healing properties and being in nature really, you know, like it, just lowering the blood pressure, being calm, being in a serene place, taking your mind off of the worries of life.
One of the events in the workshop is walking a labyrinth, and we're sitting here at the Cancer Center Garden, and right smack in the middle of it is this really beautiful labyrinth. Maybe you can describe what a labyrinth is, why people walk it, and what does that have to do with horticultural therapy?
Well, it is in the middle of a beautiful garden. So you're out, you're in the wind, you're under the blue sky, you feel the sun on your face, you see the trees all around. There's birds and rabbits running around.
There's two right there. I see them playing over there by one of the trees,
which I'm sure the master gardeners aren't, you know, excited about, but you know, we love seeing the rabbits
because they eat the plants.
Yes, they eat the plants. Well, you know, a labyrinth really is, you take a moment to walk the labyrinth and just absorb the surrounding.
Well, let's take a walk around this lovely garden. It's such a beautifully landscaped garden.
McLean County Master Gardeners really have worked hard in partnership with the Community Cancer Center, and they've really been thoughtful in how they wanted the people of Community Cancer Center to interact with the garden. So they did put in the gazebo and the waterfall, and the Community Cancer Center put in the labyrinth. But then they thought about, well, we want them to see the butterflies and the bees. So they did a lot of nectar and pollen plants for butterflies and a lot of plants for bees. So not only are you interacting with the plants, you're interacting with the insects. So I think that's really special about the garden. And then, you know, just a couple of things. They have some edible plants like the amelanchier.
Let's look at that. I'm not familiar with that one.
Well, it is a small native shrub, kind of cool gray bark, and then, you know, really small leaves. But then you see these kind of reddish purple berries on the end. Usually it would be a lot more, but obviously the birds have feasted today. But you go ahead and you grab one of the darker ones.
Very good. It's sweeter than a blueberry.
It's delicious, isn't it?
It's great. Are there any studies or statistics that show being out in nature can help people with a physical ailment, a mental disability?
Yes, actually, University of Illinois is doing some of that research right now. We have a a landscape architect professor called named Dr. Sullivan, and he has done some studies to see what having nature in a outside of a school does for the students. And what one of the things that he found was that if a student actually saw nature outside their window or walked in nature for 5 minutes before the test, their anxiety for that test was much lower, and they actually performed much better. And they had less, anger issues, less problems in the classroom. We also have another professor. Her name is Dr. Andrea Faber-Taylor, and she did a lot of the work on gardening with ADHD, and she found that it had some really positive effects of limiting some of those problems in the classroom. Overall, they have also been studying what does having garden and nature and trees and grass mean for a community. And they've found that it has amazing impacts on the community. People are less likely to commit crime. People feel more at home. There's lower stress. And just, you know, our lives are so amazingly busy, and we have so much packed in, and sometimes we just need to take 5 minutes a day to experience nature.
Thanks so much, Kelly, for talking about the garden and the workshop. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I'm Judy Valente.
The Gardening is Healing Horticultural Therapy Workshop taking place tomorrow from 9 to 4 at the Community Cancer Center in Normal. The fee is $40. Breakout sessions include creating floral designs, walking the labyrinth, sensory gardening, working with dried flowers, and nature journaling. Thanks to Mike McCurdy, Judy Valente, and Laura Kennedy for today's show. I'm Charlie Schlenker. See individual stories and full episodes at WGLT.org. This is WGLT Normal.